Okay, so good morning and welcome to the morning meeting of the students in McGill's Investment Management Program here at the Digital Tele Faculty of Management. While we study in the Investment Management Program, we are also working at the Digital Tele Capital Management, a registered investment management firm, which is the manager of the Digital Tele Global Equity Fund and the Digital Tele Fixed Income Fund. This morning you will hear some investment ideas and investment research from students in the first year of the program. You will also be able to ask questions after the presentations. There will also be coffee and pastries afterward if you have a few minutes at the end to meet with them. Thank you. So my name is Mark Lee, and today I'm going to be talking to you about Sturm, Ruger & Company. It trades under the New York Stock Exchange under RGR. So this was as of last Friday's close. As of yesterday afternoon, it was trading at 12:26, so that gives it a market cap of just about $230 million and an enterprise value of about $180 million. Last year, it made about $27.5 million in earnings on $270 of revenue. So just a little bit of a background. It's a company incorporated in Delaware. It's a premier consumer name in the firearms industry. About 98% of its revenues come from firearm sales, and more than 96% of that from U.S. domestic consumers. Its products can be grouped into four broad categories, so rifles, shotguns, pistols, and revolvers. Just to put some numbers on that, last year it did 100,000 rifles, 1,000 shotguns, 90,000 pistols, and 60,000 revolvers. Distribution-wise, it's principally focused on the commercial sporting market. So these are very rough estimates because most, with the exception of Ruger and Smith Wesson, all the companies in this space are privately held. So it's estimated that Ruger has about 15% market share in rifles and handguns and a negligible presence in shotguns. So looking at industry trends over the last 10 years, so this is the most commonly used proxy in the industry for firearm sales. When Bill Clinton signed the Brady Bill in 93, it required everyone who purchased a gun in the U.S. to undergo an instant criminal background check. So over the last, from 99, where the data starts, we've seen a 2.8% compound growth rate annually each year. And over this time period, there's been negligible correlation with unemployment rates, population growth, GDP growth, and crime rates. So over this goes up to 2007, and the only outlier here was October 2001. So what we've seen in the last 2 years is there's been the industry firearm sales have grown 13 and 10% respectively in 2008 and 2009, and there's widespread speculation that's because of speculative buying ahead of feared legislative changes by Obama. He had stated in his electoral campaign that he wanted to bring back Bill Clinton's 1994 assault weapons ban. So while that doesn't look like it's going to happen anymore, most people fear that once the speculative surge stops, there's going to be a steep drop-off in industry sales. So you see here last year, at its peak in April 2009, the sales are 60% higher than what would have been predicted based on the decade trends. But what's actually happened this year is that while the consensus analyst estimate is a 20% drop-off year-on-year, we've actually seen pretty strong data for January and February. Seasonally adjusted, it's the strongest since the first half of last year. Year over year, that's a 4.5% decline as opposed to a forecasted 20%. And seasonally adjusted, like monthly average seasonally adjusted, we're actually up 3%. So what would explain the apparent discrepancy between what happened in a post-surge decline and what's actually happening so far this year is the actual demographics of the purchasers. So over the last 10 years, what we've seen is that while the population of gun owners has been on a steady decline, the people that do own guns have been buying more and more guns, which has more than offset the decline in gun owner population. But what we've seen in the last 2 years is that 80% of gun purchases has been by first or second time owners, and that the gun owning population may have grown by 5 to 10% in 2009. So that's significant because if that's true, then not only are we not going to see a big drop-off, it may actually drive industry growth rates. So as these people become gun enthusiasts, if they adopt the habits of current gun owners, then we could see 150% basis points in the industry growth rate in the medium term. Sorry, I just neglected to mention one of the main reason that this could be true is that a lot of people are buying guns not because of anticipated regulation, but because of the massive unemployment that we have in the U.S. right now and the feared inner city decay and the perception of lack of safety going forward. So in case this isn't true and we do in fact see a decline, it's important to understand RGR's exposure to a decline in firearm sales. Historically, it's been strong in revolvers, hunting rifles, and .22 caliber offerings, so non-tactical and mostly recreational offerings. So in the surge, and ahead of anticipated assault weapons ban, most of the weapons that you would see in the surge are assault weapons. So that would lead us to the conclusion that most of the gains that RGR has seen in the revenue of the last 2 years are not attributed to just a surge in assault weapons buying, but market share growth. So its portfolio is underweight in tactical weapons, and they only have a few weapons that would have been affected by 1994 type assault weapons ban. The only real assault weapon they have is the SR-556, which was only introduced in the middle of last year, so it doesn't represent a huge amount in the 2009 revenues. And we've seen that in Q4, where distributor sales, where the industry sales tapered off. Their distributor sales to retailers are still strong. So this is my income statement model. Key assumption here is obviously decline in 2010. What I have factored in here is a 10% industry decline. If I put in 20%, which is the consensus estimate, then I get my EPS for 2010 is within the range of analyst expectations. So looking at two-way sensitivity analysis. If we do in fact get a 20% drop off, and the median forward PE ratio over the last 10 years has been 16. So if we get a 20% year-over-year industry drop off, and the median reverse to 16, we should be looking at a 9% gain. Looking at a more conservative but more reasonable 10% drop off, we're looking at a 30% gain, and if the industry only declines 5%, which is about what we've seen so far this year, we have a 0.5 multiple expansion, which would be consistent with 150 basis points growth in the industry, then we're looking at 42% upside. So the investment thesis is that once the uncertainty in the industry lifts, after the surge, the multiple should revert to the mean. 2008 and 2009 revenue growth was mostly due to idiosyncratic and not just the buying surge. And also, we're going to see a soft landing in the firearms industry in 2010. It's not, the industry sales aren't down a projected 20%. It's only down 4.5% year to year. And the purchasing demographic is not consistent with a speculative buying surge, and it could be a longer-term thing. So there's only, as previously mentioned, there's only one publicly traded comparable, and that's Smith Wesson Holding Corp. So because Smith Wesson Holding Corp has a much higher leverage, Rugged doesn't have any, EV to EBITDA is a more relevant metric to look at. Here I adjusted EV to EBITDA because inventory levels at a historical low, and in the financial reports management had indicated that they wanted to add $13.5 million in inventory next year, so I added that back in as operating cash. And we're looking at it trading at a 24% discount relative to Smith Wesson and Holding Corp based on EV over EBITDA. So the main risks to this investment are higher than expected firearm sales decline, legislative risk, and lean manufacturing initiative initiated back in 2007 or in 2006. This is because if they keep low inventory levels and they're not sufficient, then it could bottleneck production and negatively impact sales. So looking closer at legislative risk, the regulatory environment has actually been very positive in the last 2 years. While Obama had stated interest in looking at the assault weapons ban, he obviously has other priorities right now. So right now there's a 28-year-old Chicago handgun ban is up for review, and it's expected to be overturned. 2 years ago, we had a similar decision regarding handgun ban in D.C. Also, we've seen that assault weapons ban isn't a gun control isn't really a priority for Obama. As in 2009, he signed bills allowing passengers to carry firearms in national parks and in Amtrak trains when they were attached to bills that he wanted passed. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
Any questions? So was there anything that was a blip off after September 11th, right?
Yeah.
Can you argue that this is sort of very low beta stock, that it's really crazy stuff happens in the world that the company will actually do well?
Yeah, it's a really low beta stock. Oh, yeah, so Peter asked if after September 2001, there was a big blip in firearm sales, and the question was if I could argue that this is a very low beta stock, it could do well if the market as a whole doesn't do well. Yeah, it is a very low beta stock. The three-year monthly beta is about 0.16, and then the five-year is actually a negative 0.17, so it's a very low beta. Over the time period that I looked at, firearm sales weren't correlated to unemployment, but we never really had unemployment as high as we do now. So if that leads to a lot of inner city decay and that increases crime rate, or at the very least it's going to make citizens more fearful, I think that's a lot of upside in that. Ian?
I may have missed these points, but I didn't hear anything about the ownership of the company, and I didn't hear very much about management in terms of significant changes, loss of senior personnel, anything of that nature. Could you discuss those issues?
So the question was, I didn't address if I could address management, if there were any concerns about loss of key personnel and what big changes they were making, correct?
And the ownership of the company.
It actually switched from, in about 06, it switched from family ownership and family control to a bunch of guys that had been in the company for a longer period of time. So right now, in 07, they initiated lean manufacturing, so they switched from large batch processing to small batch processing, and that really reduced overheads and their cost of goods sold. Since they've only been there for about since 06, 07, so I don't know, they don't have intentions to leave anytime soon.
And the existing management have a significant stake in the company, an ownership stake? They bought shares. If so, what is the percent owned by the people that are operating the company today?
Yeah, so the question is that does management have a significant stake in the company? Have they been buying back shares in the recent past? And what is the percent owned by the people that operate it? While I don't have the exact figures for percent ownership by management, there have been heavy insider purchases in the last year or so. I think just last month we had a director buy in the neighborhood of $350,000 in company stock.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Yuan You Yu. Today, I'm going to talk about China's macroeconomic situation. I'll start with the performance comparison between among all the major economies in 2009 and walk you through with all the major indices of China's economy. And then I'll summarize the presentation talking about the currency issue and the outlook for China in 2010. So almost all the major economies in 2009 suffered, and most of them experienced a negative GDP growth, except China and India. Both countries, the better performances of these two countries were mainly due to the huge investment in domestic infrastructures. China realized an annual GDP growth rate of 8.7%. If we took a longer-term perspective, we will find out that China have constantly maintained the their annual GDP growth rate around 8% level. The only exception is actually was two decades ago. And even during the Asia financial crisis, the country was able to maintain the annual GDP growth rate around 8% level. Actually, each year, there are 5 million of college fresh graduates from college looking for a job. And there are another like 10 million of farmers coming into city and try to look for a job. So basically, that's why China's government wants to keep the GDP growth rate at around 8% level. That's to make sure that to create enough job for them. And if we take a closer look at monthly PMI, for last year, the Purchasing Manager Index has been constantly above 50%, which indicates that the industrial production has been quite stable for the last 12 months. The latest PMI index was 52% in February 2010. And we can also see that the non-manufacturing part, the PMI, has been experienced a substantial drop, but that was mainly due to the seasonal factor. However, the economic recovery has some uncertainty, which is related to export sector and also government stimulus. Firstly, why export is an issue. Even though the export, the year-on-year monthly export growth jumped to somewhere near 50% recently, but the absolute value of export has been dropped since December 2009. And we can also see that the absolute value of net import has been shrinking for 4 months consecutively since October 2009. Also, the recent new export order index, which was February 2010, dropped a lot, which indicates that in the near future, the export, there is some uncertainty related to export sector. Why is government stimulus a problem now? Let's take a look at China's steel industry as an example. The industry actually supplies steels to numerous downstream industries like real estate, automotive manufacturing, electronics, home appliances, etc. And the industry actually benefits most from the government stimulus plan last year. If we take a look at the apparent consumption of crude steels in China, we'll find out that the apparent consumption jumped unexpectedly by 23% in 2009, which means there were 106 million tons of crude steels added in the country, actually consumed in the country. And in 2008, the net import in 2008 of crude steel in China was around 46 million tons, while that number actually was merely minus 7.4 million tons. So that 106 million tons of crude steel added to China includes around 40 million tons, which was expected to be export, but consumed domestically, and another 66 million tons was newly added to the industry. Therefore, when the government stimulus plan phased out, which may happen gradually this year, it will be an issue whether the market demand will fully take over the newly added, this huge production capacity in an efficient way. That would be a problem for steel industry. That would be a problem for the downstream industry as well. So let's take a look at the money supply. The growth rate of money supply in 2009 actually doubled that in 2008. So as the GDP growth cannot exceed the growth rate of M2, which means the discrepancy between the newly added nominal demand and the actual supply, the discrepancy between these two will have to be met up with the price rises. That's why we see that there will, it's likely for China to face an inflation pressure in the second half of the year, especially starting from second quarter to third quarter. Of course, there is another opinion basically saying that the current oversupply situation and the sort of relatively soft demand will kind of help ease this inflation pressure. But we have to pay attention to another issue, is that China has this huge imported inflation from raw materials and also the recent food price rises, because the same situation happened not a long time ago in 2007, 2008. So the CPI, the monthly CPI has turned into positive since November 2009, and the PPI recently rose mainly due to the price rises of metal and energy. And the government set a target for annual CPI this year at 3%, but I would say it will be a difficult task based on what we have discussed. It will be a difficult task for the government to achieve. What about currency? The currency and the exchange rate actually are hot topics nowadays, but people actually have different opinions, even in China, on whether the currency, the RMB, should appreciate or not. What I would like to talk about is the prerequisites before China makes any movement in this issue. First of all, the U.S. economic recovery has to be confirmed. Because as we all know that China and the U.S., they have kind of a strong economic relationship. Without a strong U.S. economy, China government won't move any. It's kind of like revalue its currency. And secondly, China's annual GDP growth rate has to be stabilized at 8%. That's kind of the political needs of China's government. And the export growth comes back, which means the growth rate constantly at 10%. That's the oversupply situation in China, basically. So to summarize the presentation, I would say I'm not bullish on China in 2010, but I would expect it to be steady because of the listed reasons. And it will be interesting to see that how the driving force of the economy is to switch from government stimulus to market forces. That concludes my presentation, and I'd like to take any questions. Oh, the question is the relation, kind of the causal relationship between the U.S. economy and China economy, right? So basically, China's economy is mainly like export-oriented. So a lot of growth would rely on export. So that's basically why China needs a strong economy before revaluing its currency. And that's also what happened in the past. If U.S. economy doesn't kind of recover, the impact the U.S. can put on China will be like diminishing. So basically, it's kind of like the conflict. But from a China's perspective, that's what they expected. Of course, I know that from the U.S. perspective, they also have a kind of different perspective. It all depends on how they play the game, actually.
There is much of an issue with the supply with the steel industry. I think the
lot of like really bad qualified capacity that will end up coming offline, but it seems to me that with the amount of 20 million people that are urbanizing every year, if they still got another 5 or 6 years of educated mass infrastructure to that extent. To me, I think the biggest issue is on the GDP side, if you look at the components, you have to split up to personal consumption, fixed asset investment growth, government spending, and net trade. Which one of those four components do you think is at greatest risk for China not being able to meet that 8+% of GDP growth? I know it's, let me give you the cold nose version of the question. So, if you take a look at the GDP components, those four components, which one do you think is at the greatest risk for them not to be able to achieve 8% growth?
The question is the risk related to GDP 8% growth, which is the biggest risk, right? Actually, I would say the biggest risk is, as I said in the presentation, is when the government gradually phases out its stimulus plan, whether the market will be able to handle that capacity. It's actually artificially created by the government. Because when you say steel industry, the concentration of the industry, actually China has been trying to consolidate the industry for many years, but it had never happened. If I remember correctly, the top 10 players in that industry can only steal like 35% of the total steel supply to the country. So basically that concentration rate stayed at that level for a long time. Wugang, a few kind of state-owned. The problem is that when they are trying to acquire the privately owned sort of bigger players, there is quite a huge... I would say different opinions, because private owners, they don't want to be consolidated. That's how they can, because they actually, from my perspective, they are more efficient than state-owned. But on the other hand, if they play against the government's behavior, there will be a huge problem for their operations in the future. So basically, it's always like the conflicts, but I would say it will gradually happen. So far, they have been consolidated a few large privately owned steel mills, and there are a lot of them. They're trying to expanding their production instead of being acquired. So they have to stay bigger. That's why the whole industry kind of like keep expanding for a long time. So that's how I think actually the oversupply issue will still be the problem for the economy. The question is about the U.S. impact on China, right? Actually, from a Chinese perspective, I would say it's very difficult for China to, they can, diversify their trading activities, like their shares. Goes to U.S. and goes to EU, but eventually, if you look at how the China government make their decision, they still use the U.S. government or the U.S. economy as an indicator for them to move. Yes, EU is sort of like coming up, but now we're facing these euro problems, and I would say that in the foreseeable future, the U.S. economy would still be an indicator for China, and they won't all of a sudden switch from the U.S. to the other one. So basically, that's why I said the U.S. economy will still be a kind of like an indicator for the government, for China's behavior.
Do you think that U.S. will re-become the largest trading partner for China?
even if they won't be the largest one anymore in the future, but still China relies a lot on the U.S. and not just the normal tradings, but also the technology part, and also the sort of political relations. After all, the U.S. is still the strongest country in the world. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to be giving a crude oil update. Generally, there are a lot of factors you want to consider when talking about the price of crude oil, but with the time allotted today, I'm only going to be able to touch on a couple of these. I'd like to start with the economy. Energy demand is a function of general economic health, and lately, with the rise in oil prices, the energy sector has been gaining. This can be seen when you look at WTI crude spot prices. Prices are beginning to strengthen as world oil demand increases and spare capacity decreases. This is especially interesting to look at when you consider that not only a year ago, oil prices were trading in the $40 per barrel range. Looking at future contracts, not long ago these curves were in steep contango, and recently they have flattened out considerably. This is showing us again that near-term prices are being bid up as demand conditions return to the environment. You generally want to look at these three things when considering oil prices, demand and to-from supply, but today I'm only going to really touch on demand, and specifically demand coming from North America and the refining market. This year, world oil consumption is estimated to grow by 2 million barrels per day. This growth is not supported by developed countries, though. It's supported by emerging markets. As you can see, China there steadily growing. It's especially interesting to look at the relationship between U.S. GDP and U.S. oil consumption. Historically, the ratio has been about 1-to-1, but we've seen this decoupling recently, and this is showing us now that U.S. oil is a stagnant market in terms of oil growth consumption, and in fact, they probably will never return to their peak growth that we saw in 2005. This has an interesting implication on Canada. Looking at U.S. oil imports into the United States from Canada and Saudi Arabia, we can see that the Saudi Arabia has steadily been decreasing their exports into the United States, and they're choosing now to export the majority of their oil into China. Canada, on the other hand, has not diversified its focus. This is going to create an interesting future where they're supplying to a very stagnant market and already fighting excess capacity in their pipeline industry. Looking at the downstream, there's been a recent demand shift. Up until about 2000, the refining market was heavily oversupplied, and this just diminished margins for investors and erased any incentive that they had to invest in new capacity. And this trend reversed at about 2002. Demand caught up with supply, and the margins increased, and incentive returned to the market for new capacity investments. But the nature of the industry is that there's a large lag time between when you invest and when that capacity comes on stream. So it just so happened that in 2008, when all this new investment capacity came on stream, the economy crashed. And this has left the refining market heavily oversupplied. So if we look at demand from U.S. refinery runs, we can see that they're clearly depressed. And in fact, U.S. refineries are now closing at the fastest pace in the last three decades. From the supply side, looking at U.S. distillate fuel stocks, we can see that stock levels are remaining above average, which just shows us that the markets are still massively oversupplied. The third thing you want to look at is refinery utilization, and it's been steadily downtrending from its average there, just revealing excess refining capacity. So the result is that not only will product prices remain softer than oil prices, they'll actually weigh down on the oil complex. An interesting implication now is the WTI versus WCS spreads. WCS is the Western Canadian Select. It's an Albertan benchmark, and it's the heavier grade of the two oils. WTI is the lighter grade. And historically, as you can see, WTI has traded at a premium to WCS. So referencing the time period I was talking about before in 2002, when there's a huge amount of more capacity investment in the environment, what investors were investing in is the capacity to upgrade or the capacity to change WCS, refine WCS, the heavy oil, into WTI, the lighter oil, because it was more profitable. So when we talk about where we are today in a market that's extremely oversupplied, what we're specifically oversupplied in is the lighter WTI oil. So this increased upgrading capacity has narrowed the spreads between WTI and WCS. And this is giving a significant advantage now to the Alberta heavy oil producers, the WCS producers. I just want to look at now these trends I've talked about and put them into a forecast and investments. In terms of the forecast, in the short term, we can see that OPEC compliance is trending downward, increasing supply. Demand is returning, yet it's still extremely fragile. And we have on the refined products a massive oversupply. These three trends combined, I'm expecting range-bound prices for oil about $90 per barrel. In the long term, we can see emerging markets creating a demand bubble, having some of this demand eat into the excess supply, and having oil balance hopefully around $100+ per barrel. And now putting these trends into an investment. When we look at Canada, we see that it's now supplying to a stagnant market, which means that the companies that are going to be profitable and competitive in the future are the low-cost producers. You also want a company that is going to get advantages from the shift in downstream supply and demand, as well as the narrowing of the spreads between WTI and WCS. So I believe that a company that's perfectly positioned to adapt to these changes is Cenovus for two main reasons. The first reason is that they have an industry-low steam-to-oil ratio, which makes them one of the lowest cost producers. And the second reason is that they have their reserve base is Alberta oil, which is the majority of it is heavy oil, meaning that they're going to really benefit from the shift changes as well as the narrowing of the spreads between the heavy and light crude oils. Thank you. Are you talking about the environmental impacts? Of course. So one of the great things about Cenovus, the question is if we need to be worried about U.S. being a little hesitant on importing dirty oil. And Cenovus is what is considered an in-situ producer, which in Latin I think means in place. So instead of mining the oil, which is really what the dirty oil is about, what they do is they're drilling a well into the ground by injecting steam, which has a lot better implications environmentally. And they're using horizontal drill systems that basically brings the oil up on site instead of having to scrape the soil pretty much to the crust of the earth. That they will be having increased demand?
Yeah, it seems to me that there's going to be an increase in demand, but you think maybe that's not going to last?
In the long term, I absolutely think it will last. The question was talking about emerging markets and the increased demand coming from them. Basically, I think that especially when you talk about China, that's where the majority of this is stemming from. The demand is definitely in the long term, and I think it will last. I guess bubble isn't really, I guess, the right word in that sense. It won't it's not so much as a bubble, but just in the future, what's going to drive the price of oil since other consumers are no longer growing in that sense.
Thank you.